They didn't let up the pressure and soon began working on a plan to drive the mafia out of Las Vegas, threatening to eliminate a major source of revenue for Giancana, the Chicago Mafia, and especially Johnny Rosselli. The second major result of the Chicago Sun-Times article was that it caught the attention of CIA Director John McCone, leading to another fateful decision for Richard Helms. Instead of giving McCone the full story of the CIA Mafia plots to kill Fidel, Helms instead told McCone that the plots had lasted only from 1960 to May 1962 and had ended. Helms didn't inform the CIA director that he was continuing the plots into 1963 without authorization. He couldn't do so without losing his position. The CIA Mafia plots were a deep secret, even within the CIA, with only a handful of trusted officials like Desmond Fitzgerald, Helms's protege, E. Howard Hunt, David Morales, and William Harvey, still working on them. Helms must have felt confident that his dark secret would never leak, even within the agency. Chapter 11. Oswald in New Orleans, Dallas, and Mexico City. Kennedy aides explained to me, and declassified files confirm, that ultimate control for the JFK Almeida coup plan rested with Robert Kennedy, acting on behalf of President Kennedy. They delegated the leading role in the coup plan to Army Secretary Cyrus Vance, named as the Executive Agent of the Department of Defense for Policy Toward Cuba, Joint Chiefs Chairman Maxwell Taylor, and General Joseph Carroll, head of the Defense Intelligence Agency. Secretary of State Dean Rusk told me why he and Defense Secretary McNamara couldn't have had a knowing role in the JFK Almeida coup plan while it was being developed. They had far too many aides and staff and met too frequently with the press, so it would have been impossible to maintain the coup plan's tight secrecy. Rusk said he understood that and wasn't angry when he found out soon after JFK's death that the extensive plans that he, McNamara, and other officials had been making over the summer and fall were not just-in-case contingency plans, but were for a real coup that was just days away when JFK died. Harry Williams told me that E. Howard Hunt resented the fact that the CIA had only a supporting role in the JFK Almeida coup plan. That was probably also true for Hunt's mentor, Richard Helms, and may have been one reason Helms kept pursuing the unauthorized CIA Mafia plots. One of the most important of the CIA supporting operations for the upcoming coup to topple Castro was the introduction by CIA as soon as practicable of assets into Cuba for the development of intelligence and the development of a suitable cover plan, according to long-secret declassified files from 1963, never shown to the Warren Commission or the House Select Committee, that I was the first to quote in 2005. This important CIA attempt to move assets into Cuba would accelerate through the summer and into the fall, and would include several men linked to JFK's assassination, including Lee Oswald. The CIA allies of Marcello, Traficante, and Rosselli, working on the JFK Almeida coup plan, including David Morales, Bernard Barker, and David Ferry, would use the agency's efforts to put assets into Cuba as part of their plot to kill JFK. In that regard, Rosselli's friend David Morales was in a position to influence the actions of CIA officer David Atlee Phillips, while Traficante's man Barker could impact the actions of E. Howard Hunt, all without Phillips or Hunt being aware that Morales and Barker were really acting on behalf of the mob bosses. Marcello's men, David Ferry and Guy Bannister, had the important task of using the CIA's plan for getting assets into Cuba to make Lee Oswald look guilty after JFK was murdered. Oswald's covert activities appear to have been largely controlled by Bannister and Ferry during at least the first 9 months of 1963. On one hand, Ferry and Bannister were acting for U.S. intelligence, as later described by New Orleans Deputy CIA Chief Hunter Leake and Victor Marchetti, former special assistant to Richard Helms, both quoted in earlier chapters. Since their main CIA files remain unreleased, it's not clear whom in the CIA Ferry and Bannister were reporting to, though David Attlee Phillips was involved by the summer of 1963. However, at the same time, Bannister and Ferry were also acting on behalf of their employer, Carlos Marcello, making sure many of Oswald's activities would later make him look guilty of JFK's murder. Bannister and Ferry both hated Fidel, and aside from whatever Marcello was paying them, they no doubt hoped that blaming JFK's death on a seemingly pro-Castro communist would trigger the U.S. invasion of Cuba that both men knew was being planned. Lee Oswald's public activities in New Orleans in August 1963 are incredibly well documented because of extensive media coverage of them at the time, which resurfaced quickly on television and radio after he was accused of shooting JFK. Oswald first tried to join the local chapter of the DRE, an American anti-Castro group that grew out of Kubela's old DR group in Cuba. While meeting with the head of the tiny New Orleans DRE chapter, Oswald claimed that he wanted to overthrow Fidel. Shortly after that, Oswald presented a completely opposite impression by very publicly passing out pro-Castro Fair Play for Cuba committee leaflets on the street in New Orleans, an act that provoked an attack by the same DRE official and two of his associates. Oswald's arrest led to newspaper coverage, as well as radio and TV appearances, in which he handled himself remarkably well. How could Oswald, or any lone left-winger in the conservative South, generate so much publicity? Court records indicate that a Mr. Phillips, with U.S. intelligence from Washington, met with Bannister at his office in New Orleans and that they discussed an anti-Castro TV appeal. Dr. Gerald McKnight later confirmed that it was indeed CIA propaganda specialist David Attlee Phillips who'd met with Bannister the previous year. Recall that earlier, Phillips had run an operation against the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, and according to E. Howard Hunt's sworn testimony to congressional investigators, David Phillips also ran the DRE for the CIA. Thus, in 1963, Oswald was dealing with two organizations involving Phillips, the DRE and the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. CIA files confirm that at the same time Oswald was generating remarkable publicity, David Attlee Phillips was working on Manuel Artime's AmWorld portion of the JFK Almeida coup plan. The actions of Phillips and Oswald reveal that Oswald's unusual pro-Castro publicity blitz was part of the CIA's efforts to place U.S. intelligence assets in Cuba. That would include a face-to-face meeting with Oswald within weeks of Oswald's publicity blitz, followed by Oswald's trip to Mexico City as he attempted to leverage that publicity into permission to fly to Cuba. Before looking more closely into those activities, it's important to focus on aspects of Oswald's New Orleans street fight incident that the Warren Commission didn't know about or chose to ignore. Gerald McKnight observed that during Oswald's 5 months in New Orleans, all his known activities were consistent with what is called in the intelligence game, building a cover. On May 26, 1963, Oswald had founded a New Orleans chapter of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee entirely by mail, and it had exactly one member, Lee Oswald. Moreover, he never made a serious effort to recruit anyone else. He continued to avoid real American communists and socialists who might have been sympathetic to Cuba. Dr. McKnight points out that instead, before the leaflet incident that led to Oswald's arrest, he took the unlikely recruiting step of first passing out pro-Castro, hands-off Cuba flyers to Navy personnel attached to the aircraft carrier USS Wasp at New Orleans Dumain Street Wharf on June 15, 1963. Only 9 months after the tense naval action during the Cuban Missile Crisis, it would be hard to find a group less likely to favorably respond to pro-Castro flyers than U.S. Navy personnel. Clearly, Oswald hopes to provoke a reaction from them, preferably in the form of a punch or other physical altercation that he could leverage into an arrest record and publicity. However, the Wasp's crew only complained, and Oswald was peacefully sent on his way, notes McKnight. Oswald's first leafleting incident on June 15 occurred when he was working for the Riley Coffee Company, run by William Riley, a staunch anti-communist who hated Castro. David Kaiser writes that Riley was deeply involved in INCA, a private propaganda organization attempting to combat communist influence in Latin America and the United States. Oswald was officially fired from his job there on June 19, but 4 weeks later he debated the director of INCA on live radio in New Orleans. After leaving the Riley Coffee Company, Oswald held no job, officially at least, for the next 3 months. Unofficially, witnesses, including a CIA asset, saw him working for and with Guy Bannister and David Ferry. Oswald would have earned little money since he was still under tight surveillance by naval intelligence in hopes that the KGB would try to contact either him or Marina, so he couldn't appear to have significant unexplained sums of money. In addition, keeping Oswald low on funds was a way for Bannister and CIA officers like David Phillips to ensure that he had little choice but to do what they asked in hopes of a large payday down the road. As Oswald prepared for his second attempt to get himself arrested for passing out leaflets, one building with two addresses became important. Dr. Kaiser points out that some of Oswald's pro-Castro Fair Play for Cuba Committee leaflets were stamped with the address FPCC 544 Camp Street. Kaiser writes, "This was one of two addresses used by a corner building, the other being 532 Lafayette Street, where Guy Bannister Associates had their offices." Bannister was, of course, staunchly anti-Castro, and the addresses are simply one more indication that Oswald was working for Bannister in the leaflet operation. As noted earlier, historian Richard Mahoney documented that six witnesses saw Oswald with Ferry or Bannister in the summer of 1963. Two of them said that Oswald was working for Bannister at that time. Declassified Files and Michael Kurtz later revealed additional witnesses. One, uncovered by Kurtz, Consuela Martin, provides a new explanation of why Bannister's office address appeared on the pro-Castro leaflets. Kurtz writes that Martin's office was next to Bannister's and that she saw Oswald in Bannister's office at least half a dozen times in the late spring and summer of 1963. On every one of these occasions, Oswald and Bannister were together. Oswald sometimes asked her to do translating work for him by typing documents into Spanish. Martin believes that the 544 Camp Street address was used in hopes of luring unsuspecting pro-Castro leftists to Bannister's office, thus yielding more information for Bannister's voluminous files on leftists, all of whom he viewed as communists. Though no one would suggest that Oswald was as far-right or anti-communist as Bannister, in the Cold War environment of the early 1960s, many liberals, most notably John and Robert Kennedy, were also anti-communist. David Kaiser points out that far from being a sincere member of the far left, Oswald only embarrassed the Fair Play for Cuba Committee and the Castro cause in the New Orleans area, and his behavior throughout resembled that of an agent provocateur, rather than a genuine communist, Marxist, or other member of the far left, no matter what Oswald claimed in his media appearances. Aside from Oswald's using the address for Bannister's building on some of his pamphlets, there is one other curious fact about them. Oswald handed out copies of the first printing of The Crime Against Cuba, a pro-Castro pamphlet printed in the United States in 1961. One copy wound up as FBI evidence after the assassination. However, Oswald was in Russia in 1961 when the first printing sold out. Only the fourth printing of the pamphlet was available when Oswald returned to the United States and in the summer of 1963. Oswald would have needed help in obtaining dozens of copies of the long-sold-out first printing. It's possible that Bannister ordered one or two copies for his files in 1961, but he had no reason to order dozens of copies. The pamphlet's author was 90 years old when researcher James DiEugenio located him, but he had saved a copy of the $3 28 June 1961 purchase order he had received for 45 copies from the Central Intelligence Agency, Mail Room Library, Washington 25, D.C. Those first printing pamphlets had been ordered when David Atlee Phillips was running operations targeting the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, making Phillips a possible source of pro-Castro literature for Oswald's PR efforts. Though Oswald wouldn't succeed in provoking a fight by handing out leaflets until August 9, 1963, 5 days before that, in a letter postmarked August 4, Oswald had written to the New York office of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. In the letter, Oswald says that his street demonstration was attacked by some Cuban exiles and that he was officially cautioned by police. Clearly, Oswald was writing about what he planned to have happen 6 days later. In addition, Dick Russell notes that despite Oswald's repeated writing to the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, whose mail the FBI closely monitored, and other communist organizations, Oswald's name was never included on either part of the FBI's security index, not even after he went on to set up his highly visible Fair Play for Cuba chapter. Oswald's absence from the list was especially odd, since he was a former defector to the Soviet Union. So Russell asks, had the FBI received word from someone to keep a relative distance from Oswald because he was considered part of another intelligence operation? The Warren Commission was never able to satisfactorily answer that question, because if Oswald had been on the security index, he would certainly have been subject to law enforcement attention on the day of JFK's motorcade in Dallas. The local DRE chapter in New Orleans was run by a Cuban exile named Carlos Bringeyer. While the DRE was a real organization managed by the CIA, the New Orleans chapter was tiny. FBI files indicate that it had only one delegate, Bringeyer, and that its activities were limited to propaganda-type efforts in any available channel of the news media. Oswald first approached Bringeyer on August 5 in his clothing store, offering to help train anti-Castro guerrilla fighters. Bringeyer, an acquaintance of David Ferry, was suspicious of Oswald and declined his offer. 4 days later, on August 9, Oswald returned to the area to promote himself publicly as proudly pro-Castro. As Dr. McKnight points out, Oswald had noted in his address book the concentration of Cuban exile stores in the area of his demonstration, and if he wanted to make sure to attract Bringeyer's attention, he was in the very heart of New Orleans' exile community. Oswald was handing out hands-off Cuba flyers and wearing a placard around his waist with Viva Fidel written in large black block letters. Oswald soon engaged in a confrontation with Bringeyer and two friends. Oswald provoked Bringeyer by dropping his hands and putting his face close to the enraged burly Cuban and taunting, "Okay, Carlos, if you want to hit me, hit me." At that point in the confrontation, the police arrived and arrested all four men for creating a public disturbance. A New Orleans police lieutenant who talked to Oswald after his arrest later testified to the Warren Commission that Oswald seemed to have set them, the exiles, up, so to speak, to create an incident. The police lieutenant also said that Oswald liked the president, a sentiment shared by most people who ever heard Oswald mention JFK. A police sergeant observed that Oswald knows very little about the Fair Play for Cuba Committee that he belongs to and its ultimate purpose or goal. A New Orleans attorney later testified to the Warren Commission that Oswald had told him he was being paid to hand out pro-Castro leaflets on the streets of New Orleans. However, Oswald's arrest and subsequent trial were prominently reported in the New Orleans papers and on TV, which seems to have been the goal for both David Atlee Phillips, who was trying to build Oswald's pro-Castro credentials so he could get into Cuba, and Bannister, who wanted to make Oswald look like a pro-Castro communist. In addition to Guy Bannister, Two other Marcello connections are evident upon close inspection of Oswald's August 1963 incident. John Martino's son told a former congressional investigator that in August 1963, Martino saw Lee Harvey Oswald passing out pro-Castro leaflets in New Orleans. That is around the time that witnesses place Martino with Carlos Marcello and Guy Bannister. Historian Kurtz cites the former superintendent of the New Orleans Police Department as saying that Martino met with Marcello himself at the Town and Country Motel, where Marcello had his office. A close associate of Carlos Marcello's lieutenant, Nofio Pecora, arranged Oswald's release from jail, as documented by the director of the House Select Committee on Assassinations. It's interesting that Jack Ruby had called Pecora just 6 days earlier. According to historian Dr. John Newman, Oswald's August 12 trial was well attended by local television and newspaper reporters. Only 4 days later, evidently unworried about being attacked or arrested again, Oswald once more passed out pro-Castro leaflets on a New Orleans street. Though unemployed, Oswald reportedly hired two helpers, paying them $2 apiece to help pass out his pro-Castro leaflets. One of the men, who appeared Hispanic, has never been identified. Oswald passed out leaflets for only a few minutes, yet the demonstration was filmed by WDSU-TV. On August 17, 1963, a WDSU radio host contacted Oswald and invited him to be interviewed on a weekly radio show. The radio personality admits he had been briefed by the FBI on Oswald's background. Oswald came across as very intelligent and well-informed. On August 21, the WDSU radio host moderated a radio debate between Oswald, Carlos Bringeyer, and Ed Butler, who worked with the anti-communist propaganda group INCA, which included Oswald's former employer at the Riley Coffee Company. Oswald was again articulate and did well in the debate until he was confronted on the air about his defection to Russia, which he had not mentioned. Oswald was apparently not prepared for that, which seems odd since his defection was well publicized. However, the subject had the effect of discrediting the Fair Play for Cuba Committee to the listening public, which is what David Attlee Phillips had been trying to do for more than 2 years. According to author Dick Russell, after the taping, Oswald popped into the WDSU TV studio for a quick interview and said, on film, that he was a Marxist. That was good for helping Phillips build Oswald's pro-Castro persona, but that footage would be played endlessly after JFK's murder, cementing, in much of the public's mind, that Oswald was a dangerous communist. CIA officer David Attlee Phillips met with Oswald in Dallas in late August or early September 1963, apparently to debrief him after his New Orleans media appearances. Oswald had built a public and documented record as firmly pro-Castro and had handled a variety of situations well. Phillips was ready to prepare him for his next assignment, to be one of the U.S. assets going to Mexico City to obtain Cuban permission to fly to Havana. While the United States could use speedboats to sneak assets and agents into Cuba at night, those people couldn't travel freely or openly talk to lower-level officials and the public, and thus could not gauge the level of public support for the coup. Since the United States had no embassy or diplomatic relations with Cuba, and since travel to the island was severely restricted, the United States needed a number of assets who could travel openly. As a former defector to Russia, someone like Oswald was especially valuable because if he ever got into trouble, the United States could claim that the Russians were behind his activities. Phillips' meeting with Oswald was unusual for two reasons. It occurred openly in a public place in Dallas, and it involved Cuban exile leader Antonio Veciana of the CIA-backed exile group Alpha 66. Veciana and his Alpha 66 group were barred from the JFK Almeida coup plan because of their earlier attack on a Russian ship in Cuban waters. However, Veciana was also very close partners with Eloy Menoyo, One of the exile leaders the Kennedys and Harry Williams wanted to participate in the JFK Almeida coup plan. Veciana's story of meeting Oswald and Phillips in the lobby of the new Southland building in Dallas has been controversial, though congressional investigator Gaetan Fonzi concluded that such a meeting did take place. Veciana hinted that Phillips used the name Maurice Bishop, and CIA official Ross Crozier later confirmed that to congressional investigators. Kurtz found new confirmation, saying that Hunter Leake told me that David Atlee Phillips used the alias Maurice Bishop. Veciana revealed to my researcher, Tom Hartman, that he originally named his group Alpha 66 after the Phillips 66 gas stations that were common in the early 1960s. David Atlee Phillips came from nearby Fort Worth, and by meeting Oswald in public in the lobby of Dallas's newest glittering office tower, Phillips must have realized he could have been seen with Oswald by someone who knew him. Such behavior seems illogical and inconsistent with Phillips' long intelligence experience, unless Oswald was being used as an intelligence asset for an operation far from Dallas. In addition, it's hard to believe a veteran CIA officer like Phillips would be in public with Oswald in Dallas if he knew that Oswald was going to be an assassin or a patsy for JFK's assassination in that same city. The Phillips-Oswald-Veciana meeting makes sense if Phillips was using Oswald in the CIA's anti-Castro operations as one of the U.S. assets the agency planned to move into Cuba before the coup. Apparently, Phillips hoped Oswald's pro-Castro media blitz would help him get into Cuba via Mexico City. Phillips was based in Mexico City, where he headed anti-Castro operations. In addition, Phillips played a major role in the CIA's Cuban operations based in the United States, ranging from being a part of the JFK Almeida coup plan to handling Cuban exile groups like the DRE and Alpha 66, as well as generating anti-Castro propaganda and working against the Fair Play for Cuba committee. Some of Phillips' most sensitive anti-Castro operations, for Washington CIA officials Richard Helms and Desmond Fitzgerald, were kept secret from most others in the CIA, including Winston "Win" Scott, the CIA chief of station in Mexico City. Antonio Veciana said that Phillips had summoned him from Miami to the Dallas meeting so they could discuss plans to kill Castro. Veciana also claimed that at the Dallas meeting, Oswald and Phillips were talking about something that we can do to kill Castro. Gaetan Fonzi notes that David Morales also worked closely with Phillips. He wrote that Morales was away from the Miami CIA station a lot in 1963, usually on trips to Mexico City. That close relationship between Morales and Phillips also meant that Johnny Rosselli could learn from his close friend Morales what Phillips was working on. In 1963, David Morales, who admitted helping to assassinate JFK, still outranked David Atlee Phillips and could easily have proposed to Phillips that he meet Oswald in public and that Veciana be allowed to see Oswald for some reason. Years later, Phillips wrote a never-published autobiographical manuscript, part fact, part fiction, which has been quoted in Vanity Fair and other publications. In it, Phillips confirmed that Oswald was part of the CIA's effort to assassinate Fidel Castro. He added that President Kennedy was shot using precisely the plan we had devised against Castro. Phillips wrote that the plan involved using a sniper's rifle from an upper-floor window of a building on the route where Castro often drove in an open Jeep. In some ways, that confirms something indicated in later AmWorld memos. The CIA planned to have Fidel shot in his open Jeep as he drove into Varadero Beach. On the other hand, Phillips built a long and decorated CIA career as a propagandist using half-truths, distortions, and lies, so what he wrote must be taken with a grain of salt. It was also probably designed as damage control in case files or testimony emerged that could harm the reputation of Phillips or the CIA. While there is probably some truth in what he wrote, Oswald was not an experienced assassin, and the CIA would have no more trusted him to murder Fidel than the Mafia would have used the inexperienced Oswald to shoot JFK. However, as with JFK's murder, Oswald did have the proper background to be an excellent patsy to take the blame for Castro's death. If Phillips had no knowing role in JFK's murder, it's also possible that someone like David Morales manipulated things so that Phillips and Richard Helms believed Oswald was a bad apple who used the plan we had devised against Castro to kill JFK. The result would have been, and was, that Helms and Phillips would withhold substantial amounts of crucial information from the press, the public, their superiors, and other agencies. Based on the statements of both Phillips and Veciana, Oswald appears to have been involved in the CIA's attempts to kill Fidel Castro. That, perhaps, casts the meeting between Oswald and Marcello in a different light, since the Godfather was also part of the CIA Mafia plots to kill Fidel. Essentially, they were on the same side and doing work for the same agency. As for Oswald, his recent flurry of activity and upcoming attempt to get into Cuba through Mexico City no doubt made him think his years of undercover toil were about to pay off in a big way. The FBI found telling notes that Oswald wrote, and that the Warren Commission left out of its report because they clashed with the Commission's view of Oswald as an ardent communist. Instead, they were included only in the Warren Commission's rarely seen 26 volumes of supporting material. In the notes, Oswald wrote that the United States and Russia have too much to offer to each other to be tearing at each other's throats in an endless Cold War. Both countries have major shortcomings and advantages, but only in ours is the voice of dissent allowed opportunity of expression. Oswald makes it clear in these notes that he still hates communism, writing, "There are possibly few other Americans born in the U.S. who have as many personal reasons to know and therefore hate and mistrust communism." According to the Warren Commission, Oswald wrote these notes for a speech by Lee Harvey Oswald, but never delivered the speech. It was the kind of oration Oswald could have given only after he was no longer undercover and had been revealed as a U.S. asset, perhaps scoring a lucrative book and television deal like his childhood idol from I Led Three Lives. After meeting Phillips, but before going to Mexico City, Oswald apparently traveled from New Orleans to Dallas. There, someone, most likely someone working with the Mafia, such as Martino, Bannister, or Morales, manipulated Oswald into visiting Silvia Odio, thus linking him to both JFK's assassination and another of the exile groups in the JFK-Almeida coup plan. Oswald's Odio visit and the exile's follow-up phone call don't appear to have involved David Atlee Phillips, because they seem to undermine what he was trying to do with Oswald. By connecting Oswald to several parts of the JFK-Almeida coup plan, those working for Marcello, Traficante, and Rosselli could ensure that when Oswald surfaced as the main suspect, the CIA and other agencies would have to cover up much information to protect the coup plan, which is exactly what happened. Historian John Newman, a 20-year veteran of military intelligence, posed the question, why did Oswald come into contact with so many people with CIA connections in August and September 1963? He named five individuals, but more have since emerged, including John Martino, whom the CIA admits was a CIA asset, David Ferry, and David Atlee Phillips. One of those Newman named was William Godet, a CIA asset who worked for Inca's founder. It's now clear that Godet was part of the tight surveillance of Oswald mentioned earlier. A former Senate investigator wrote that before his death in 1981, Godet admitted witnessing Oswald's distribution of pro-Castro leaflets in New Orleans. Historian Richard Mahoney says that when Oswald applied for and received a Mexican tourist card, FM 824085, in New Orleans on September 17, 1963, The individual who received the tourist card with the previous number, FM824084, was William George Godet, who had close ties to the local office of the CIA. Godet later admitted under oath that he had seen Oswald one day in deep conversation with Bannister on Camp Street. They were leaning over and talking, and it was an earnest conversation. Godet said his impression was that Bannister was asking Oswald to do something for him. William Godet later saw Oswald in Mexico City, as he explained to Michael Kurtz. Godet's testimony is further proof that Oswald was involved in U.S. intelligence activity in 1963. It also helps explain why he was never placed on the FBI's security index before Dallas. Yet, Godet's observations are further proof that Oswald was working with Guy Bannister, who was part of Carlos Marcello's plot to kill JFK. Whole books and a massive congressional report have been written about the unusual aspects of Oswald's trip to Mexico City in late September 1963, when he apparently visited both the Cuban and Soviet embassies. However, for JFK's assassination, only a few facts are key. First is that Oswald visited the Cuban embassy on the same day as two other unusual young men, and all three tried to get Cuban entry visas. One turned out later to be working for intelligence in Nicaragua, one of the countries where Manuel Artime had an AmWorld base and worked with the intelligence service. Summers says the third young man behaved as though he was on some sort of undercover mission in Mexico, and his movements ran parallel to Oswald's. This young man worked for intelligence in Costa Rica, which was the other country where Artime had an AmWorld base. Thus, all three young men appear linked to Manuel Artime. The CIA was clearly attempting to slip multiple assets into Cuba through Mexico City at the same time in the hope that some might get through. Oswald was under surveillance by U.S. intelligence in Mexico City, according to Wynne Scott, the CIA's Mexico City station chief. Scott said the CIA's hidden cameras photographed Oswald at the embassy, and he saw photos of Oswald there. The House Select Committee on Assassinations found additional evidence of the existence of photos of Oswald in Mexico City. However, only unrelated photos of someone else who looked nothing like Oswald would be furnished to the Warren Commission and eventually made public. That's probably because the CIA's photo surveillance operation in Mexico City was under the control of David Atlee Phillips, who was no doubt acting on orders from Richard Helms. One reason for withholding the Oswald Mexico photos, and denying the CIA had known Oswald was in Mexico, would be that Oswald was involved in a highly sensitive, covert operation run by Phillips and Helms. It was important for JFK's murder that someone didn't want Oswald to actually get to Cuba. We know that because five phony calls claiming to be from Oswald were made to the Russian and Cuban embassies while the real Oswald was in Mexico City. We know these calls, monitored for the CIA, weren't really from Oswald because the person or persons making them spoke broken Russian, in which Oswald was fluent, and excellent Spanish, a language Oswald didn't speak. The Mafia had the connections to ensure that he never got to Cuba. A Mexican police agency involved with Traficante's heroin network monitored the Cuban and Russian embassy calls for the CIA, while mobster and active CIA asset Richard Kane had formerly bugged a communist embassy in Mexico City. At the time of Oswald's visit, a flurry of odd cables flowed between the Mexico City CIA station and CIA headquarters in Washington along two different paths. One path carried accurate information about Oswald to Desmond Fitzgerald and Richard Helms, while the other conveyed inaccurate information about him. Washington Post reporter Jefferson Morley interviewed a former CIA official who told him that CIA records suggested that members of Fitzgerald's staff seemed to be carefully guarding information about Oswald in the weeks before Kennedy was killed. The person managing both the accurate and the inaccurate information about Oswald was Richard Helms' assistant. After JFK's murder, and for almost three decades later, Helms maintained that before the assassination, the CIA hadn't even noticed Oswald's embassy visits. Declassified files now show that claim to be completely false, as documented by historian and retired major John Newman. The actions of Oswald and the CIA are consistent with Oswald's being one of several U.S. intelligence assets the CIA was trying to get into Cuba openly. In fact, a Warren Commission memo left out of its final report showed exactly how Oswald could have been planning to travel to Mexico City again and on to Cuba on November 22, 1963. As an American with a pro-Castro persona, Oswald could have openly walked the streets of Havana or Varadero Beach talking to Cubans and low-level officials. Additionally, Oswald's time in Russia would have made it possible to blame any problem he had in Cuba on the Russians, something CIA notes by William Harvey indicate was always essential for an assassination mission. After analyzing many recently declassified files, Naval War College professor and historian David Kaiser concluded in 2008 that, in all probability, Oswald's attempt to reach Cuba via Mexico City was designed to give him an opportunity to assassinate Castro. I agree with Kaiser that Oswald was trying to get into Cuba as part of an effort to eliminate Castro, but I disagree that Oswald intended to assassinate Castro. He didn't have the experience necessary for such a task, and he'd never killed anyone. But he could have had a supporting role in a Castro elimination plot, and he would have made an excellent fall guy. Oswald had been part of an operation against Fidel when he was in Mexico City, and after his failure to get into Cuba, Oswald had probably been told, likely by Bannister, Ferry, or Martino, that he still was part of such an operation. Even as Lee Oswald prepared to return to Dallas from Mexico City in early October 1963, one more important link was being forged between Oswald, JFK's assassination, and the JFK-Almeida coup plan. The training camp outside New Orleans, where David Ferry reportedly took Oswald, was a sort of minor league training camp for Manuel Artime's AmWorld portion of the JFK-Almeida coup plan. The camp's owner later said that he bought arms for Ferry, who in turn got them from U.S. Army personnel who had stolen them. Declassified files show that some arms reported stolen from National Guard armories in the Texas area were actually being supplied to Cuban exile leaders like Manolo Reyes' JURE group, which JFK and RFK wanted for their coup plan. Other military personnel were taking advantage of that situation by stealing and selling arms and keeping the money. In October 1963, the Treasury Department tried to stop the trafficking in stolen arms with an undercover sting. Surprisingly, FBI and Treasury Department memos from that operation quote a Dallas gun dealer as giving a fairly accurate description of the upcoming JFK-Almeida coup plan. The Dallas gun dealer said that in the last week of November 1963, a large-scale amphibious operation would take place against the Cuba mainland, and United States military forces or government agencies would possibly be involved in this operation, which involved an attack by rebel Cuban forces. Writers for the Washington Post linked longtime gunrunner Jack Ruby to that same stolen military arms ring. As for the gun dealer, who accurately described the upcoming U.S. action against Cuba, the Washington Post said he was the gun dealer who sold the bullets used in Oswald's rifle on November 22, 1963. That means even the bullet found in Oswald's rifle after JFK's assassination had been connected to the JFK-Almeida coup plan. By October 1963, Carlos Marcello faced losing his empire, his freedom, and even the ability to stay in America unless he ended Robert Kennedy's extraordinary power by killing JFK. Two dates in particular now loomed large for Marcello. He was scheduled to be tried in New Orleans on federal charges on November 1, 1963, with one of RFK's own mafia prosecutors, John Duguid, handling the trial. Anxious to avoid the deportation a conviction would bring, Marcello would soon begin efforts to bribe a key juror. However, that was at best only a temporary solution, since the Godfather knew that even if he was not convicted, RFK would launch a new investigation as soon as that trial ended. Indeed, the Justice Department would later prosecute him for bribing the juror. RFK was already focusing on serious tax charges against Marcello, and the Mafia chief knew he would have no respite while JFK was alive. Carlos Marcello knew he had to act before the coup took place and removed his only opportunity to force a cover-up by top U.S. officials. Marcello had nothing to gain and everything to lose by allowing the JFK-Almeida coup plan to go forward. Robert Kennedy and aides such as Harry Williams had made it clear that as long as JFK was president, Cuba would never be a safe haven for Marcello, Traficante, or any other mafia boss. The date for the coup was firming up to be sometime in early December 1963, something Marcello, Traficante, and Rosselli could have learned from their CIA allies in the JFK plot, like David Morales and Bernard Barker. If Marcello killed JFK before the coup, it would force Robert Kennedy, CIA Director McCone, military leaders like General Maxwell Taylor, and others to withhold critical information from investigators, the press, and the public to prevent a confrontation with the Soviets that could go nuclear. With the coup date looming, Marcello and the others organized attempts to kill JFK in November 1963 during motorcades in three different cities, Chicago, Tampa, and Dallas. Marcello relied on his trusted associates, the Chicago mob's Rosselli and Traficante in Tampa, to help him oversee the plot. First, they would try to kill JFK during his long Chicago motorcade on November 2, 1963, the day after Marcello's trial was set to begin. The mob boss's year of careful planning meant that even their backup plan, Tampa, during JFK's November 18 motorcade, had a backup, Dallas, on November 22, and that each city's mafia family equally shared the risk. That risk would be minimized by the mob bosses using only experienced men they knew they could trust. The mafiosi had come up with one basic plan that could be applied in each of the three cities. Because the opportunities were so close together, the bosses could use most of the same personnel for each attempt. Each of the three target cities had a key mafia operative close to law enforcement, who would monitor any leaks about or investigations into the JFK hit. In Chicago, the mob's top made man in law enforcement was Richard Kane, who was also chief investigator for the Cook County Sheriff. The CIA continued to deal with Kane in the fall of 1963, giving him a pipeline not only into law enforcement, but into intelligence as well. In Tampa, Traficante's man was Sergeant Jack De La Llana, who had formed and become director of the Tampa Police Department's first criminal intelligence unit. As revealed in Senate hearings in October 1963, when De La Llana testified while posing as an honest cop, he was also chairman of the Florida Intelligence Unit, a statewide agency which coordinates information throughout the state of Florida. This cooperation even extended to other states, as shown when Sergeant De La Llana exchanged information with the New Orleans Police Department about the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. As described to me by Chief Mullins and others, who didn't realize De La Llana was working for Traficante in 1963, De La Llana was the perfect man for the Tampa Godfather to have on the force. In Dallas, Jack Ruby could serve a similar function. Though Ruby wasn't a member of law enforcement, his friendly contacts with Dallas police were long-standing and ran deep. According to government files, Ruby knew at least 700 of the 1,200 Dallas policemen. Several officers and Ruby associates claimed that Ruby actually knew every Dallas policeman. Ruby was particularly close to several corrupt cops, as noted earlier. One Warren Commission document called Ruby the payoff man for the Dallas Police Department. One key requirement of the assassination plan was the same for Chicago, Tampa, and Dallas. JFK would be killed in public in a moving car. Shooting JFK in a moving car gave the mafia several advantages. The mob bosses knew from earlier motorcades, like JFK's spring 1963 trip to Chicago, that Secret Service agents rode with the motorcade and were not on the ground except at the beginning and end of the route. This meant that if JFK was shot en route, no Secret Service would be stationed at the site of the shooting. Even better for them, shooting JFK in a car, as opposed to blowing it up, would take the Secret Service agents away from the crime scene, since they would have to stay with the motorcade to protect the president on the way to the hospital. The mafia's plan to kill JFK was very similar to the CIA's plan to kill Castro in the CIA mafia plots, and likely to Almeida's part of the coup plan. For top U.S. officials who knew about the coup or the CIA mafia plots, hearing how JFK had been shot would be an additional shock that would make maintaining the secrecy surrounding the coup plan a top priority. That cloak of secrecy would also help obscure the mafia's role in JFK's death. We noted earlier David Atlee Phillips' autobiographical manuscript about the CIA's decision to have Fidel shot with a sniper's rifle from an upper floor window of a building on the route where Castro was riding in an open Jeep. The sad irony is that the mafia may have taken the very plan the CIA had intended to use against Castro in his Jeep and adapted it to kill JFK in an open limousine. More confirmation for the CIA's approach to killing Castro comes from declassified CIA files and from Manuel Artime's top lieutenant from M-World, Cuban exile Rafael Chichi Quintero. Speaking of a later version of an M-World plot to kill Fidel, Quintero said the plan was to shoot Castro at the Varadero beach. Still another, later CIA M-World document, which mentions Commander Almeida, says the assassination of Fidel is to take place in public so that everyone can see that the leaders have been killed. Killing JFK in public, in a car, would ensure that the CIA, Robert Kennedy, and other high officials recognized immediately on hearing the first reports of the tragedy the similarity between JFK's death and the plans to eliminate Castro. How the mob could have applied the CIA's Castro plan to instead assassinate JFK becomes clear when we consider the October 1963 Senate testimony of Neil G. Brown, who was stepping down as Tampa police chief at the end of the month to be replaced by J.P. Mullins. Chief Brown provided the senators and the press with a remarkable summary of how Tampa's Traficante conducted and got away with mob hits. Much of it reads almost like a script for what happened in Dallas the following month. Brown's Senate testimony makes it clear that Traficante, as well as Marcello and Rosselli, would do on a larger scale with JFK's assassination what they had already done successfully in the past. Brown testified about Traficante's ties to Rosselli's boss, Giancana, and to a French Connection heroin partner, Michel Victor Mertz. Next came his accounts of Traficante's direct links to several murders, in addition to many others he had ordered. After noting Traficante's role in the still officially unsolved barbershop slaying of New York mob boss Albert Anastasia, Brown explained that Traficante had been picked up by the police for questioning about the gangland slayings of three other men over the years, but authorities were unable to prosecute Traficante for those hits because the Godfather took care to insulate himself from mob executions, using intermediaries and professional hitmen to carry out his dirty work. Brown pointed out the relative infrequency with which such professional murders are successfully prosecuted, and explained why. He said that police had solved only one of 23 mafia murders in Tampa, and the lone exception was not a typical mafia hit. Brown said it was very difficult to obtain evidence sufficient for successful prosecution of mafia members, because the witnesses who might offer such evidence have always been reluctant to do so due to fear of mafia reprisals, since it is common knowledge in Tampa that the mafia does not hesitate to murder those who talk to the authorities or testify. One of the Traficante hits described by Brown in his testimony is very similar to what happened to JFK and Oswald. Brown said Trafficante targeted a victim whose head was blown off while he was seated in his automobile. Then the main suspect in this murder was himself murdered, as happened with Oswald. Chapter 12. Carlos, Marcello, and the Hitmen for JFK's Murder. Even as JFK's plan with Almeida proceeded in the fall of 1963, he and Robert Kennedy looked for a way to find a peaceful solution to the problem of Cuba that wouldn't involve what one memo called a bloody coup. Historians have long known that the Kennedys initiated two separate back-channel attempts to negotiate with Fidel in the fall of 1963, one using pioneering TV journalist Lisa Howard and special UN envoy William Atwood, and the other through French journalist Jean Daniel. The JFK-Almeida coup plan helps explain the urgency of those efforts at that particular time. However, neither of the Kennedys' secret peace efforts had produced any breakthroughs, and that would continue to be the case up until JFK's assassination on November 22, 1963. To maintain deniability in case the secret talks were exposed, JFK had to work through William Atwood, who in turn talked to Fidel's doctor, who dealt with Fidel. The parties were wary of each other, and the negotiations slow. Fidel also had to deal with factions within his own regime, with one Atwood memo to JFK noting that Fidel didn't want Che Guevara to find out about the secret talks because there was a rift between Castro and the Guevara and Almeida group on the question of Cuba's future course. JFK kept his own secrets from Atwood, not telling him that, barring some dramatic breakthrough in the secret talks, JFK and Bobby planned to allow Almeida to overthrow Fidel in December 1963. Frustrated by the slow pace of the Atwood negotiations, yet anxious to avoid a violent coup if possible, in late October 1963, JFK asked French journalist Jean Daniel to talk to Fidel on his behalf. But Fidel had kept Daniel cooling his heels in Havana for weeks. Daniel would not get to see Fidel until November 21, the day before JFK's trip to Dallas. No real progress was made in their talk, but Fidel was intrigued enough by Daniel's message from JFK that he invited the journalist to a follow-up lunch on November 22 at Castro's villa at Varadero Beach. However, Daniel could not securely communicate directly with JFK or Bobby about his talks with Castro, so the Kennedys would have no way to know that Daniel was finally speaking with the Cuban leader. John and Robert Kennedy had basically one overall goal for Cuba by late October 1963, to resolve the situation so that the United States could peacefully coexist with Cuba. That could come about with a peacefully negotiated settlement, if possible, but if not, they would try to bring it about by supporting Commander Almeida and the Cuban exile leaders with their coup, hopefully leading to eventual free elections and democracy in Cuba. President Kennedy, RFK, and other key officials in the Kennedy administration were very concerned about Cuba and the 1964 election. William Atwood said in a memo that they needed to remove the Cuban issue from the 1964 campaign. Talks with other Kennedy aides show that John and Robert Kennedy shared that opinion, and it was one factor in scheduling the JFK-Almeida coup plan for December 1, 1963, a date confirmed in a memo by CIA Director John McCone and by RFK's top exile aide, Harry Williams. That way, the Cuba situation would be resolved, one way or the other, before the official start of the campaign in January 1964. In addition, CIA files and Harry Williams said that after December 1, Cuban officials planned to institute a draft which would dilute the loyalty of Commander Almeida's army, allowing Cuban intelligence and other rival factions in the Cuban government to infiltrate his ranks. As Dean Rusk and a Kennedy aide explained to me, having the coup by December 1 was also necessary so that U.S. troops wouldn't be fighting in Cuba during the Christmas holidays, and any U.S. air support for the coup would be over before the Pearl Harbor anniversary on December 7. What would happen if Fidel found out about the JFK Almeida coup plan, or one of the less advanced efforts like Amtrunk, and decided to retaliate against the United States in some way? That question was obviously on the minds of John and Robert Kennedy, who took steps to deal with just such a situation. Today, even most historians have no idea that in the days and weeks before JFK's murder, Robert Kennedy had a secret subcommittee developing plans for what to